Support for Boston Public Radio comes from Davis Malm. Their tax lawyers are committed to your most taxing matters. Learn more at davismalm.com. That's DAVISMALM.com. Davis Malm. Lean. Agile. Strategic.
WGBH. WGBH HD1 Boston. Online at WGBHnews.org. Boston's local NPR.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio with Marjorie Egan and Jim Browdy. Although education didn't get a lot of airtime, during the presidential election, Joe Biden included it in his victory speech last weekend.
For American educators, this is a great day for y'all. You're going to have one of your own in the White House.
Of course, by that he means Jill Biden, who's been a full-time English professor at a community college in Northern Virginia and apparently intends to keep on teaching, which I think is great. In addition to having a community college advocate in the White House, what else will the Biden administration mean for public education? Joining us online to talk about this and other education headlines is Paul Revel. Paul's professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Lane Weiss, Broader, Bolder, Better, How Schools and Communities Help Students Overcome the Disadvantages of Poverty. Hey there, Paul. Hello, Paul.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie.
Hi.
Hey, how are you, Paul?
By the way, before you continue, I just realized we forgot to say... someone who's not is Corey Lewandowski, former campaign manager for Donald Trump, who was with us last week, not in person, has tested positive for the coronavirus. I'm sorry. Go ahead, Marjorie.
So, Paul Revel, before we get back to Joe Biden and what could happen, let's talk about what's happening locally. You have Governor Baker becoming more and more adamant about reopening schools in person. He's saying that he's not aware of these big spreads in schools. You have stories from parents talking about this. The Globe featured the other day this Andover mother whose kid is getting only 30 to 60 minutes of live education from a teacher a day. She's learning math on YouTube videos. You have this really sad story today about kids that have special needs. You know, Boston shut down the schools late in the afternoon on October 21st, and everybody had to kind of fend for themselves. And meanwhile, apparently half of the school systems in Boston, in Massachusetts, are completely remote. I mean, this sounds like just a mess. And other states are doing much better.
Paul?
Yeah, well, there's a real jumble. Yeah, can you hear me?
We can. Actually, we're going to put you on hold, Paul. We have a multi-second delay. If our colleagues in the control room can try to call Paul back and see if we can get a little better connection here, it would be great. Those numbers are pretty amazing, by the way. I was aware that there were a lot of people doing hybrid, Marjorie. I was not aware that such a large percentage of school districts in Massachusetts were 100% remote. It's pretty amazing.
Well, Jim, as we know, you won the President's Award from the Massachusetts Teachers Association.
It is not just... By the way, I know you feel otherwise. We'll discuss this with Paul when he returns in a second. There are a lot of parents who are really nervous, too. And, I think Governor Baker makes a powerful argument at these press conferences. And if it was a test, he'd win. The problem is there are a lot of nervous parents in communities that used to be red zones until they changed the rules about how they calculate red zones, that are nervous about sending their kids to school.
Then they don't have to send their kids to school.
I know
but there
that, yeah.
are a lot of parents. Then they can keep their kids home. But there are so many parents who are desperate to get their kids in school, particularly parents of special needs kids. And I know that there's a lot of parents in communities of color, African American parents, et cetera, that are nervous because they've been unfairly targeted by COVID. On the other hand, those are the kids in poor districts and very large school districts of color that are really getting the shaft.
I understand that, but can you understand an adult who happens to be a teacher being nervous about teaching in that classroom?
And I understand people that have to go to CVS and be cashiers and people that have to go to the supermarkets and work there. Everybody's nervous.
Well,
I mean, I guess it's about a risk. Okay, so we were arguing, of course, about
the
teachers union while you were gone,
no,
Paul.
We weren't.
So we'll spare you that.
Right.
Go ahead,
but
Paul.
There does seem to be a risk balance analysis that, from what I've read, is off.
Well, I mean, we're keeping lots of different kinds of facilities, ranging from public transportation to gyms, in some cases movie theaters, certainly restaurants, and a lot of places where it's been declared unsafe to be in school, despite the fact that there's not a great deal of evidence that schools are super transmitting kinds of places. For example, in New York City today, they're considering shutting down the schools altogether. They have a 0.17 positivity rate in New York City right now in the schools where they're measuring it. And yet in the city, it's much higher, and they're considering locking down the schools if only to stop students from being out on public transportation and diminish the traffic there, but they're not shutting down restaurants. And this is the case in many cities across the country where schools are not in session, but many other kinds of public gathering facilities are in session. And, you know, it continues to be the case that that young people are the least likely to transmit this. The incidence rate in the younger ages, it, at any rate, is lower, and the degree of severity once they have it is smaller. At the same time, having said that, there are legitimate issues that teachers are worried about going into work but getting infected themselves and their families. I was on a panel recently with a colleague at the Chan School of Public Health, and he's Joe Allen, absolutely convinced that with a relatively modest set of investments by comparison to some of the things that we're talking about today, we could put in place safe conditions that would make it much more advantageous for us economically, from a health standpoint, certainly from a learning standpoint, to bring students back in a safe way and put them in classrooms as opposed to keeping them out of school. So there are scientists who believe strongly, the head of the public the public health department at Brown University, used to be at Harvard,
Ashish
is on record as saying, who I think you had on
many times,
you know, is that we ought to be bringing people back, and we can do it. The science is there. You know, the problem is it has not been made a top priority at the national level or at the state level. I mean, we're getting a lot of talk about people should go back, but not as much effort in terms of putting in place the conditions that would lead to a greater sense of security among people, parents and teachers, in going back to school. So within each of our communities, there's a raging battle, and both sides, you know, have their particular perspective and sets of evidence to make their case.
Well, we are very different from New York. We should point that out. I mean, there's a lot of communities in Boston that there's a very low rate. And this woman this mother that was complaining was from Andover. But the other thing is, there's no standards for how much teacher-led instruction these kids are getting.
Statewide, you mean?
And she was complaining, as I said before, in Claire Chiesa, that her kid's getting 30 to 60 minutes a day when she's home. I guess the bottom line to me is that there is risk for everybody. It's true. There's risk for teachers. There's risk for custodians. There's risk for the kids. But the flip side is this is like kind of a slow-moving disaster for these kids. And the parents that are trying to do their jobs while they're Zoom instructing their kids, because the kids aren't getting Zoom instruction from their teachers.
The learning loss is piling up literally day to day now. And as I say, I think it needs to be a more urgent national and statewide priority to put in place conditions in schools that are going to give both teachers and parents that sense of security that they can send their children back to school safely. I do think the science is there. Well, for example, you know, with a $1 billion investment nationally, we could put an air cleaner in every classroom in the United States. Arguably, we ought to do that. We ought to do that as a matter of not only health and education, but a matter of economic preservation for the reasons you've pointed out. When kids are in school, parents can work. So whatever way you cut it, that would be a good investment to make, and we ought to be doing that. We ought to
Baker do, Paul, that he's not doing?
Well, I mean, I think you know, sort of paying more attention to what sort of state aid could be used to put in place the infrastructure conditions that need to be present in schools, for example, in the use of the CARES money that came in. Prioritizing those kinds of infrastructure improvements that make it possible to assure safety, that making sure that everybody has the PPE they need, those kinds of things. I think we've just got to be putting a greater emphasis on that, rather than simply using the bully pulpit to kind of persuade people that this is what they ought to be doing. We've got to speak to what people's worries are, and people are worried about catching the disease by coming into school. And there are things that can be done in putting in place measures that will make it possible for students to do that, and we should make that more of a priority.
Speaking about things that should be done, we're going to talk to our listeners about this in about 20 minutes or so. I don't understand why any college is allowing a student who's been on campus to go home without having a mandatory test and a result before they do. Is it only about, is it about money? I mean, I know some schools are requiring the tests. Some are making them available and voluntary. I don't understand why you would ever allow a college student to go home and potentially be a real problem for his or her family when the simple thing to do is have a test and quarantine until you get the results. Why aren't they all doing it?
Well, I think for the most part, it's a matter of, number one, them determining whether or not they have the authority to do it. Number two, do they have the resources to do it? And I, frankly, I think it's probably not a decision that really ought to be left up to the colleges. It should be a matter of public policy at this stage that if you're going to call people back to school, and we know that there's there are issues on campuses. I think the campuses, for the most part, have gotten much better at controlling and setting limits and putting in place procedures and testing at fairly frequent rates on most campuses. But if you're going to take the prerogative to call students back on campus, then you have an obligation to the public to clear them before they go home. So I think that probably ought to be made a matter of public policy now, not a matter of volunteerism by campus by campus. Otherwise, I think it's a very difficult thing to control.
When you say made a matter of
it's
public
a difficult
policy,
thing for colleges,
what does that mean? By whom?
Well, I mean, it's sort of a state regulation, a state requirement. In other words, if you're going to be a college that has students on campus, then are you're required to test them before they exit. Now, of course, this raises the question, how do campuses exercise that authority on students who can walk out the door anytime they want? But I think you have a good starting point if you put that mandate in place. And there are ways in which universities could get tough with students in terms of enforcing that they actually do that. So that's what I mean by public policy. Mm-hmm.
We're talking to Paul Revel, our education man. Paul, Biden has a much different view on the education processes than the president of the United States. What can he, of course, he always points out he's married to a teacher. What can he do? If we still have a divided government for education?
Well, I mean, there are lots of things he's committed to do. There are lots of things that he wants to do. It's wonderful to have an education president in office who's really committed to this work and committed to teaching and learning and committed to the whole proposition of American public education and developing human capital in the country. So that's a great relief in our field of education. He's obviously got a couple of major challenges facing him at a minimum, two or three that I can think of. Number one, he's got this pandemic, and that is sucking all the oxygen in the room as it necessarily has to do. And he's got to deal with that first and foremost. That has huge costs associated with it and the economic damage that has been done, which leads to the second challenge he has, which is, there aren't for all the things that he'd very generously like to do in the field of education, from tripling Title I to forgiving college loan debt to making community college free to offering early childhood to every 3- and 4-year-old in the country, all those things are fabulously expensive and many more that are on his list of what he wants to do. And the resources aren't there, nor for the moment are the politics there. If it turns out that the Democrats don't control the Senate, he's going to have a very hard time getting through any of those appropriations to fulfill many of the commitments that are on his education platform. So I think education advocates and educators generally are, you know, hoping that he'll be able to enact some of the things that he's committed to. But the spending ticket is quite large, and it remains to be seen whether the money's there, whether the politics are there, and in the first place, whether we can get by the pandemic and deal with it first.
What's the most important thing he can do without congressional approval by executive order, by executive action, that he should do, Paul, on education?
Well, part of it's bully pulpit, change the tone, change the culture, make educators feel appreciated in terms of the work they do, make parents feel that the federal government's behind them, make business leaders feel like this nation is ready to invest in human capital again, make college leaders and college students and prospective parents who are thinking about taking on debt and so forth, that we're committed to an affordable higher education, that we're committed to public higher education, that we believe that the way that we succeed economically in this country, let alone to mend our democracy, is to invest in education. So all of that, setting the tone, I think, is really important. Then there are a whole host of regulations that this administration, the Trump administration, has been very deft at handling on issues ranging from civil rights and civil rights protections in the government, to what we do about, you know, sexual harassment on campus, to the transgender rights in terms of these kinds of issues that have arisen in that area, racial disparities on school discipline, affirmative action and civil rights cases that this administration has seen fit to launch. So there are a number of executive orders, regulations and guidelines that the Department of Education has control over, that this administration will be able to remedy some of the damage. I mean, for example, the relationship of private nonprofit, private for-profit higher education institutions to government regulation has changed dramatically under the Trump administration. He can alter that. So there are lots of things that he can do in that way. But obviously, the biggest things, the most important things, are going to cost some money to accomplish, and it remains to be seen whether he'll be able to move forward on those.
Paul, thanks for your time.
Thank you, Paul.
My pleasure. Yeah, it's a hopeful, promising time, but lots of challenges ahead, so I'm sure we'll be talking about those in the future.
We will, including the appellate court decision today about Harvard and affirmative action. We'll talk, probably going to the Supreme Court. We'll do that next time you're on. Thanks so much, Paul.
Paul Revel is a professor. Right. Thank you, Paul. Paul is a professor at Harvard University's Graduate School of Education, where he also runs the Education Redesign Lab. His latest book, co-authored with Elaine Weiss, Broader, Bolder, Better, How Schools and Communities Help Students Overcome the Disadvantages of Poverty. Thanks again to Paul Revel. Up next, Donald Trump's presidency was 4 years of chaos. How he's ending it is no different, but we look at other transitions of power and why conceding is so important to the process. Presidential transitions up next on 89.7 GBH, Boston Public Radio.
Throughout the years, GBH Radio has provided news and